This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan, and with me, Julian Ng and Melissa Idris. We're going to bring you 4 hours of non-stop excitement. Toe-curling excitement, I believe. No, I'm just kidding. I have to say something different than it's an exciting lineup. I think that was a challenge that Chuan gave me. The month that you were, Melissa, says, if you can say something other than exciting lineup, you know, I'll buy you a beer.
What about here's the lineup?
Spine-tingling.
Well, you see.
Spine-tingling.
Julian, it's got to be more than that. Spine-tingling.
Earworm, what was the thing?
Earworm.
You know how, like, a catchy song gets to you?
Oh, I see. Right. Okay.
Well, what about here is what I woke up for?
Oh.
Wake up
with us.
Well, that might not sound as enthusiastic as you think it does. But we have, as we were just trying to describe, an exciting lineup for you this morning.
You reverted.
Yes. We'll start off with the breakfast grill. Today we have Brian Iskander Zulkarim. He's CEO of Damansara Realty Berhad. And he's going to be speaking with Ibrahim Sunny, as we call him. And he's an interesting man. Brian was hired as CEO for Damansara Realty in September 2016, not just a couple of months ago. He's still new in the company. But before this, he had a role as general manager of Malaysia Airports Holdings, or MAHB.
Oh, so interesting.
So I don't know if we can... Ibrahim is going to revisit the Malaysia story, especially Malaysian Airlines story, rather, see whether it has any bearing on his current position.
What I didn't know was I always thought Damansara Realty is just a property developer, but apparently they also have business in facilities management, including owning several parking lots. So they own the metro parking.
Oh, okay.
And that's, I guess, you know, for me, I always wondered why would anyone want to do that? But in KL, parking lots are cash cows,
yeah,
man.
Minting it with
that. Exactly. It's minimal effort, but, you know, the output you get is you pay.
It's amazing.
What is it in KL? It's like $30 a day people pay for parking.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's why we should have better public transport. Also, another interesting factoid about Damansara Realty is that it has strong ties to the Johor Royal House. I guess one of the natural questions.
Not Damansara, but...
Yes, Damansara.
I thought it's the man himself.
So the question, of course, is, you know, how does that affect business? The Johor Royals are big players. Not only in Johor, but here in KL as well. Also, as part of that discussion is the question of Damansara Realty's history with CEOs.
Yeah, it looks like they've had quite a turnover with CEOs. 3 CEOs prior to this current one was dismissed and no further investigation was done. 2 CEOs prior to the current one now charged in court for deceit on his resume. And the CEO prior to this current one, when I say this current one, I mean the one who's coming on the breakfast grill, Brian Iskander. The guy before him, his predecessor, resigned under extraordinary circumstances, having held the CEO post for less than a year. What is going on?
Well, usually this is a sign of a very powerful major shareholder and a sign of the head honcho of a certain company not having enough independence to do their job. So,
The legacy issues are just too heavy.
Yeah,
to carry.
Legacy and independence. Remember what happened to Christoph Müller?
Mm-hmm.
We were asking about independence of doing his job when he left short of his 2-year contract. And also, I think one thing to notice from this sort of companies is that Malaysia is so intertwined with the property development sector. Every single person out there wants to do property. There's so much going around. Johor itself is home to one of the biggest property projects, if not in Malaysia, in Southeast Asia, right?
Or in Asia.
Iskander. Mm-hmm. And did you guys see that report about how that huge Forest City development is scaring the heck out of other people in the region.
Yeah, well, you know, that's kind of clickbait for, I think, for the readers. Because when you read it...
It was a Bloomberg story.
Yeah, the Bloomberg story is interesting because it's all about how deep the pockets of these Chinese developers are, how much competition they're providing local developers, how they're really, you know... kind of developing ahead of demand, you know, anticipating demand. This is like a 30-year project.
Yeah,
this,
we're talking about, you know, tens of thousands of units of condominiums coming out over there, and people are having these visions of Chinese, mainland Chinese ghost towns right
yes,
in a backyard, right?
Yeah, so the question that's asked in that piece is, who's going to be living in them? I mean... Buying them is one thing, but living them in
and
them
and
as
this
well.
Is the thing with property, right? People, I think developers having this idea that if you build, they will come, and property becomes the end in itself rather than the means to an end. Usually, the property sector is a support to some other sectors like the industrial sector, the manufacturing sector, which houses the employees
of all
these sectors.
Okay, so they become little townships, right?
Yeah,
so.
But then, you know, every developer out there wants to become the one that represents a property center, and therefore they build all these units in the wide numbers. And it makes the market become quite boring. Because you want a diversity, you want the breadth and depth of industry in Malaysia, but we don't hear enough of that, at least from the listed company perspective.
Yeah. The other thing that was in that story that was interesting is the number of mainland Chinese people who are coming to Johor to buy. And so, you know, AirAsia set up a direct flight between a city in southern China and Johor Bahru. And on that first maiden flight, some 150 of the 180 seats were taken up by people coming specifically to look at properties in Iskandar.
Well, Malaysia, my second home. There you go.
I think the property developer in China as well, not necessarily the one who is developing for a city, but the big ones in China are not unknown to give free properties to their buyers.
Wasn't there a crackdown on that? You know, buy a property in China and you get the option, or you get a property in Malaysia.
You get
Malaysia
a free
property.
One in Malaysia, yeah. Because it's so cheap. The land apparently in Iskandar is too cheap, and therefore giving them a chance to offer this as a free gift.
So I'm going to just show that to Melissa. If you haven't seen it, 100 billion Chinese-made
city near Singapore scares the hell out of everyone. There you go. That's the headline.
Yeah,
and that is very catchy.
We can retweet this. So if you haven't caught this article, you can have a look at it. Very interesting. And property developers, how imaginative are they? We have endless numbers of malls. And I think that, for me, is the bane of our lives. Also, just coming up after the breakfast grill at about 8:35 on Current Affairs, we'll take a look at India, and this time at the government of Narendra Modi and its decision to demonetize the 501,000 rupee note. This, of course, is a story that began a week or so ago and has had all kinds of implications. And I think it's a story with lots of legs, and it's sort of carrying on. You both have been talking about it, I bet.
Yeah, and I remember speaking about some of the unintended consequences of this demonetization of the 501,000 rupees.
That's right.
The latest one, Jules, just on Wall Street Journal this morning, was the fact that employers in India, so business owners in India, having all these sackful of cashes that notes that are now no longer able to use, they're paying their employees months in advance. So say you earned how many rupees, you're getting months of your salary in advance in these notes.
In the old notes.
In the 501,000
rupees. That's naughty.
That is so naughty.
Yeah, so, but
that is so naughty. So,
okay,
so imagine
it's not like
these
employees. You can change the notes. The question is, there's a limit on how much you can change, you know, and... presumably, it's calibrated to make sense of what people actually use and could have
when
in their holding.
When you say can, it's all relative, isn't it? You can do it legally, but can you actually physically go to
a
bank.
It's a big strain. This is the problem. So the banking system in India, this is particularly bad for people in rural India who have to trek miles to a bank where this would where they would do this exchange. And you know, and so you know, various global media have been carrying the stories about people who are hard-pressed because they don't have a branch near them.
But I wonder whether Western media, in covering this story, have done a good job or have done justice to representing the actual situation in India. Because I think what we fail to understand is the dual, kind of the parallel system in India that happens, right? The one that's above board and in the open market, then one, the grey,
black
economy. And I don't think that's fully been explained. So I think someone reading this story in the West will be like, okay, I don't understand why it's such a big deal. And when you speak
or
to... it's being done at all. Yeah. And when you speak to people who have been to India or who do business with India, it's really quite fascinating. Yesterday, Jules, after our S&M show with Dr. Suresh Ramanathan, I was chatting with him. And he, of course, being a forex strategist, was looking at this issue and had such amazing thoughts about it. I will definitely invite him on the show.
We're looking forward to that show. What show would that be
on? I haven't decided yet.
Okay. interestingly, also, the demand for Rolexes have gone up as a result of this. One of the other unintended consequences of the note change. There was a store in the northwest of Mumbai seeing 45 units of Rolex watches being sold in a single day. I guess
so. Presumably, they're using these notes they're converting cash
into Rolexes.
Because going back to your story about employers paying their employees ahead of time with the old notes and people buying onto Rolexes, this is really passing on the responsibility to convert the notes to other people, right? Mm-hmm. When you buy the Rolexes, you pass that responsibility to the Rolex seller to convert the notes and the employers as well. I think it's so unfair for
them. It is very unfair.
Well, so, you know, and I think that story is going to have legs partly because of the political fallout for Narendra Modi and his own base and his party's base, the BJP.
Remember, guys, this happened in Malaysia in the 1997-98 Asian financial crisis when Malaysia did the same thing to really cut off, to choke off the ability to transport money out of the country to change it in Singapore, right? But at that time, it didn't have a lot of consumptive consequences because I guess at the time, everything was gloomy and people were not going out there to splash money on things.
But Julian, it's also the question of the note that was demonetized. There was a thousand?
500, wasn't it? 500. Do you remember that?
500 to 1,000.
500 was the purple note. No longer in available.
So it didn't affect ordinary people because a 500 and 1,000 rupee note is much more like our 5 and 100. I mean, it's a smaller denomination, right? So in real terms, it has an effect on a daily basis, whereas how many of us carry wads of 500 notes?
You're right, 500 and the 1,000 ringgit note. So if you remember that kind of burgundy colored note.
Okay. So just to... give that information, 500 rupees is about $7.
Yeah.
So it's a very small
denomination.
Yes, it is.
Just widely used.
That's why it has such an effect on people, because it's such a commonly used note. It's like demonetizing a 10 ringgit and a 50
ringgit,
and a 10 ringgit.
It would be mayhem if we demonetize.
We could just deal in singles.
So it's not analogous to the Malaysian situation.
Now it gets me thinking. I thought
it was more.
I thought it was a bigger denomination.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was so small.
Why would corruption be hampered by the, you know, taking these notes out?
Well, you know, because a lot, if you remember all these big corruption cases in India, you know, people found with stacks and stacks of, you know, and it would be 1,500 rupee notes.
Do we know what the biggest denomination is? Let's find out and tell you after this.
Yeah, okay. Very quick look internationally. Something a little esoteric, but a small figurine of some 4,000 years. That's the age of the figure has been found in Israel. And this is of a figure of a man or perhaps a woman, looking very pensive. So it's now being dubbed the kind of the Rodin of the Bronze Age, the famous The Thinker statue. So this is, and we'll tweet out the link to that so you can have a look at this image. So human beings have been thinking about thinking for a long time.
I've been thinking about thinking.
I love it. I see the picture here on a news link from Al Jazeera, and it's ceramics. So it's... What strikes me about it is the fact that it looks like it was just simply slapped together. but looking at it, it still evokes a kind of deep thought about it. When you look at it...
is it like the thinker?
It's not as intricate.
The thinker pose, the one that looks like he's sitting on a toilet?
And it's not as intricate as...
Well, hopefully you don't sit on a toilet like that because hunched over and looking like you're in deep thought...
It looks like a football history.
Sharad, just to come back to the India rupee story, I've just done a quick check. The biggest denomination is 2,000.
Right. 2,000. So you can see it is very, very different from that Malaysian situation Julian just mentioned. Well, we'll come back with more after this at BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run. That was Ain't No Sunshine by... Michael Jackson, originally written by Bill Withers, and I think when Bill Withers sang it, I mean, I love Michael Jackson, but when Bill Withers sings that song, it really stirs the soul.
Yeah, it really does. And so, I feel something.
Yeah, when Bill Withers does it.
Yes.
It's a little too candy when the young Michael Jackson did it. So, well, there you have it. Maybe if he reprised that song as he was aging, it would have sounded very different and maybe earthier. And I think this thing about age is really important. That was Melissa Idris, who's very young. And then Julian Ng, with me in the studio, who's not so young.
No spring chickens here.
Oh, you were a spring chicken.
I was going to say young at heart, but young, that's something an old guy would say.
Yes, absolutely. So just smile, you know, sound like kind of benign old person way, and you'll probably get away with it. Oh, by the way, we are having this BFM Network series this evening. Mm-hmm. And so if you, like, it's a last minute thing and you still want to catch it, you can just... Make sure you go to the BFM website and you can click on a link that will take you to the registration.
Yeah, it's bfm.my/community. You have to sign up to be part of our community first. And it's really just, you know, hanging out, having dinner with the Morning Run crew. We really want to get to know you and, you know, just share some thoughts.
Yeah, we'll be blurry-eyed by about 7, but ignore that fact. Just... You know, just power through the fact that we look like we've it's midnight for us. Okay, coming back to the question of age, Ukraine's had two appointments as part of in government that has gotten everybody talking, or at least everybody in Ukraine talking, which has been the election of two people to very important positions. A 24-year-old has been appointed deputy interior minister, and a 23-year-old lawyer has been put in charge of the nation's anti-corruption campaign. Now, this has gotten a lot of people talking in Ukraine about whether they're too young to be qualified to do the job. And also, but just put things in perspective, the prime minister of Ukraine is 38 years old.
Oh.
Okay. So there you have a situation where, and most ministers in Ukraine are in their 30s. So people of your age, Melissa, you know, people that Julian, you and me will be looking down on and saying,
ooh,
hey,
looking back.
Well, not looking down. Okay. So this
looking
is,
down.
Anti-ageism is a very, coming to the point.
That's
right?
The crux of
it. Yeah, of the matter. So, okay. I mean, would you be concerned if somebody was put in these positions? If that was their age, I mean, just looking at the face of it.
Generally speaking, that's a concern, right? So generally speaking, I would think, 24, is she what, 23, 24?
Well,
24 is
the deputy interior minister.
So Anastasia Deyava is 24 years old. She's been appointed deputy interior minister. I would say that if to speak generally, I would have concerns. However, I also acknowledge there are extremely bright and 24-year-olds who have worldviews and really strong experiences that are separate to other...
Strong experience, that's interesting.
Yes,
because
if you're
24, how much experience could you have in the adult world?
Sometimes there are 24-year-olds, young mid-20s who have more world experience, have been through more, and have a fully formed worldview compared to some mid-30-year-olds or 40-year-olds because they've just been through so much. You can't. There are some. There are exceptions to the rule, Sharad. And maybe, let's give Anastasia Deyava a chance.
Okay, yeah. Julian, speak for the 40-year-olds.
Well, I think that you have a kind of social experimentation to it when you look at the online world and you look at the CEOs of today's vast companies that are much bigger than the GDPs of many small nations, right? You think of the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world. They are very, very young shoots, green shoots, right? And they are leading these very complicated institutions. That's one. And number two, I think there would be very different reactions from the demographics. For example, the older people might think that these guys are not experienced enough to lead the country, but the younger people might think differently and might identify with the young leaders. So if you look at the demographics of Ukraine, for example, the median age is a very young country. You're talking about a median age of slightly under 40. So a large part of the crowd over there is very young and might not mind being led by young politicians. Now, do you guys know what the median age for Malaysia is?
No. What is it?
It's, according to the very reliable Google, it's 26 years, right?
That's the median age?
Yeah.
26?
So Malaysia is an extremely young country, younger than Ukraine, but we are led by politicians who have been around for generations.
Well, okay,
and the question is whether our politicians reflect our the aspiration of these very young Malaysians.
So, well, okay, Mark Zuckerberg, just to check in, is 30 years old, or 32 years old.
Yeah, I saw that.
Isn't that extraordinary? Our Prime Minister, actually, if you compare him to the gerontocracy of the late Soviet Union, he's quite young. He's 63, and
that's compared to the median age. Look,
but he's been in politics
forever. Say is that let's compare to the median age of Malaysia compared to the median age of cabinet. What is the median age of cabinet? I guarantee you it's not 27 or 26, right?
Well, so we're talking about age, and maybe it's a cultural issue, and we immediately assume that older people will have that
experience.
Career trajectory, experience. They'll be able not just to kind of like do things in a technocratic fashion, meaning they come out of university, they know all the theories, but they perhaps don't know how to deal with people, and they don't understand where there will be resistance in a system and such, right? So that's where you would say perhaps somebody older might be able to do a better job. But, in their defense, the leadership in Ukraine is saying, no, actually, we want to get away from the Soviet-style view of leadership as having to be run not just by old people, but by old men. And old men are really the ones who dominate the world in terms of leadership. And say, well, we want the fact that you're young. We value that. So instead of trying to think of these young people as somehow, having an old soul or something, you're saying, no, actually, the fact that they're young is a good thing, especially for these jobs.
I'm just looking at this article from the BBC about Anastasia Deyava, who is the youngest ever deputy minister at 24, and she looks very attractive. And
okay,
I just hope she doesn't spend her time Instagramming her poses and spend some time making policy for Ukraine, right? Were these guys elected?
Yeah, that's I think quite unfair because granted she's posing for this article and maybe not, the most professional of posers, but that doesn't detract away from her ability to do the job, right? I mean, she's young, she can have an Instagram account. Najib Razak has an Instagram account.
Thankfully, he doesn't post like that.
Barack Obama has an Instagram account. So, I mean, there's nothing wrong with being active on social media.
The question is, we've had a lot of old people in charge, and a lot of them really, I mean, if, you know, haven't done a great job. And if Malaysia, the Malaysian experience is anything to go by. You remember Amir Mohammed's series of books, Ministers Say the Darndest Things?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they,
that book writes itself.
Yeah, they have made Amir Mohammed a very successful man because they constantly have produced material to show that the leadership isn't necessarily staffed with the sharpest tools in the box.
What if it happened here? What if it happened here in Malaysia where the deputy interior minister was a 25-year-old woman?
She would be devoured okay by the system, by the old fogies in
What about
the
Malaysians? What about us? Would we be
welcoming?
I would welcome it. I think it would be a breath of fresh air.
So let us know what you feel and whether you'd be welcoming or not. Send us a Twitter, a tweet at BFM.
Vote Melissa.
Vote Melissa, right? Well, now
Melissa, if you're up there,
okay, I'm voting.
I wouldn't even blink an eye. I would vote for you.
Okay, I'm going to be voting for Azlin Balkish. She's at the mic and ready with the first bulletin of the day. BFM 89.9. You're listening to The Morning Run. That was Julian Ng bumping his way through the studio.
tripping over
I'm not fully awake.
Or it's age. Who knows what it is?
It could be.
Ageism is a theme this morning.
And that song you just heard, A Young Lust by Pink Floyd. Melissa, people are saying on Twitter that they would vote for you. I don't know who these people are. They don't really know you.
Roland Tan. He's a regular commentator on Twitter for BFM.
Okay, so we had an extraordinary explosion of interest in our poll, which reads, would you be welcoming of a 20-something-year-old minister? Somehow, some 11 votes have come in.
Oh,
11, I say yes. Okay.
Groundbreaking.
That's okay. Even more than the median age of... No,
that's not the median age. Well, you kind of correct yourself, right? You said earlier the median age of Malaysians is at 26.
That was the 2010 number, but the 2015 number, the updated number, around 28 or 30.
So we're still young, but aging.
Do you think that it's interesting that it's almost quite evenly split? So of the 12 votes, we've got.
No, actually, it's 42% for yes and 58% for no. So,
more people would not be welcoming.
Yeah.
Interesting. I'd like to know why. I think it has something to do with
experience.
Yeah.
Or their perception.
Perception.
Because some people
lack of experience.
Have lots of experience. You think of a number of people in leadership roles who have had lots of experience and still have been the subject of many a meme in Malaysia, mocking them for the rather inane. Yeah. Ideas that they've been able to produce.
Experience doesn't guarantee good decisions.
Sometimes it can even be a liability because you're so weighed down. Yeah, you're so weighed down by the baggage.
And that's precisely what some of the arguments against this is some of the arguments for having these young people in the Ukraine
something crazy.
There was also a young member of the Ukrainian government that was brought in as head of the anti-corruption drive because a young person...
In the same week.
Yeah, they don't have the same kind of relationships or they haven't formed that kind of,
because millennials don't like money. And
they haven't had time to form experiences.
And they go like, why are you receiving this 500 rupee as a kind of bribe that's not on?
Which is
I don't know if all millennials don't want money. I know a lot of millennials who live for money and whose lifestyles demand lots of money. But speaking of somebody who made it when he was very young, but now is growing older, is none other than Bill Gates. We spoke about Mark Zuckerberg. He's only 32 years old and but one of the richest men in the world. But the richest man in the world is slightly older than he is, Bill Gates. I'm not sure how old Bill Gates is. But Bill Gates and his wife Melinda, have a foundation, and that's been part of the brand of Bill Gates now, the fact that they have these social causes. And even someone like Warren Buffett has given his money to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in order to kind of do some good in the world. And let's not talk about what billionaires should do with their money and why not giving it all to their children. But the specific project that they have, Melissa, that interests you, has to do with toilets.
Okay, so Bill Gates...
now think again, do you want to vote for Melissa Idris?
Yes, potty mouth in the morning. Okay, so Bill Gates wrote a blog post a couple of days ago to announce that he's joining forces, he and his foundation, they're joining forces with a perfume company, a Switzerland-based fragrance company, in order to improve sanitation. And the way it works, he says, is that this company, they're teaming up, it's called Firmenich. And they're working to deter people from relieving themselves in the open instead of toilets because of the bad smells of toilets. So he's found that by looking at the sanitation crisis, he's found the reason why people don't use toilets that's already built is because of the horrible smell. And he says, well, smell really matters. So if I can tackle the bad smell, then we could be able to tackle the sanitation crisis. And I wonder whether that's a tenuous link. What do you guys think?
I think it's really nipping the problem in the butt.
Really?
People, you think so too?
Ooh, like the pun. I love the pun.
I think it's a good idea. I think it's a good idea because if you, I mean, I have had personal experiences of bad toilet smell, and it really does not make you want to go.
Did you relieve yourself in public?
No, I mean, not me, but okay. I know of people who would not go and who would suffer the consequences.
Oh.
And I can understand how this would make people do it outside, in the open, in the public, and it makes the problem worse, right? So if you can make the toilet more nicer smelling, then people would not defecate or urinate in public, and that would be better for everybody else.
He's talking about developing countries. Bill Gates is talking about the problem specifically in developing countries where, despite all the effort of building toilets, people are still not using it, and smell is a huge deterrent.
There's also this other thing, which is the acceptability of doing it in public. So if I think you live in a city or in a country where actually defecating or urinating in public is acceptable, it's just that, you know, like you turn towards the wall and you pee, and people wouldn't sort of stop and scold you and say, what are you doing this in public? But I think in Malaysia, it would be a problem. I think if you did try to do precisely what we just spoke of, which is the unspeakable, in public, people would be really upset. I think there are countries or contexts in which it's not true.
I think I was in Italy recently, and I believe public urination is legal in Italy. Didn't see anything happen there, but it was a topic of discussion amongst the public. A lot of people were quite unhappy that this was made legal because, you know, they think that it's a mark of a civilized society not to, you know, that's your private business. Don't do it in the public, right? However, the other side of the argument is, why make something that's so natural a crime?
Yeah. The other thing is, you know, Manila, where I lived for about half a year, has a very innovative way of dealing with public urination. Is that they create these little, it's not like a room, which is what a public toilet might look like, right? Even a portaloo would be like a room, and you can imagine it trapping all these bad smells. This is basically just a human height kind of like wall, and it's just like a thin metal piece that goes around, and you have like something to pee into, no flush or whatever, and it's on the pavement, so you have privacy. Nobody has to watch you do your thing, but you have privacy and it's open air. And so you have all that fresh air wafting around.
Do you think that sanitation and toilet habits is a conversation we're not having enough? Now, I bring this up.
Not at the dinner table.
No. Or maybe...
Not even on radio.
At breakfast. On the morning show. Well, our boss, Malik Ali, head of the founder of BFM, he is obsessed with toilets. Now, he has this fascination about toilets. And I always questioned that. And I recently come to realize that actually he has a point, because I found myself thinking nowadays that toilets really are a reflection of society, how we treat communal spaces. It's
Absolutely.
How we think.
Narendra Modi of India also has a fixation on toilets. I think his government's been very big on, you know, getting this whole, you know, public defecation thing under control.
Yeah,
which I think is very interesting.
China as well. China has been rating their toilets for a very long time. And
Rating them?
Yeah, as a tourist, if you go to China, you can see a few stars outside public toilets. And if it's 5-star, it's definitely safe for use to the nose.
Wow.
Yeah, and they have been doing for a long time also because public, you know, doing of the business is so accepted over there. And They used to have very horrendous toilets.
I saw this quote once and I loved it. So it talked about toilet habits, right? It's private business, but should be public discourse. You know? Yeah. And I loved that because I thought, actually, it's true. Our parents talking to their children about, you know, using... Because it starts at home, right?
I think it starts at the eatery you go to. If you go to an eatery that has a bad toilet, would you stop going there? And I think, in fact, most people won't.
If they have good food.
You wouldn't stop, right? And this is very interesting.
You're not going to an eatery to do your business. But you're going there to eat,
but it's
right?
Again, it's a reflection of the place, the management, isn't it?
Sorry? I want to have the option.
I just want to go back to how you're going to solve this problem and how Bill Gates is going to do it. Because it's no mean task. It's no easy task to actually decimate the smell in a really, really bad toilet. So I'm interested in how he's going to do
the
it.
How he's going
to neutralize the smell. And I think that it's so ironic because this kind of activity are natural activities, right? And nature has a way of treating this kind of thing, your poop and your urine. But we have come to live in a very modern society with our 7 billion people, and nature, we are going against the laws of nature in how we do this sewage treatment.
The last word from you, Melissa, about defecation. Any pearls of wisdom you want to toss before us?
Let's talk about it. How to keep it clean.
Okay. 27 votes in on our Twitter poll. Will you be welcoming to a 20-something-year-old minister? 59% saying yes and 41% saying no.
Oh, it flipped.
Yeah, it flipped.
Fantastic.
Yeah, interesting. Well, there's still 23 hours left of the poll, so we'll wait to see what happens next. But what is going to happen right now is a song by Lenny Kravitz, Are You Going My Way? BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.